Good morning, everyone. We're continuing with our conversation about knowing and trusting, living intuitively, feeling God's presence and responding accordingly, appropriately, as clearly and as consistently as we can. It's a very big subject, but it's an extremely interesting one and very important. So let's start with the prayer. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Master Paramahansa Yogananda, Saints of all religions, humbly we bow to you all. Dearest friend Swami Kriyananda, bless us with your enlightening presence. Help us to use our intelligence, our intuition, and our energy in ways that bring us closer to God. Guide us away from unwise decisions and help us to see that wisdom and happiness are the same reality. We are your children. Guide us and bless us. Om. Peace. Amen. And I always say that, guide and bless. Those are words that just come to me sometimes. It's funny with words and language. You don't know where your thoughts arise from. They just come. And for me, being the person that I am, my thoughts always articulate into words. In fact, it's sort of a joke that it's not actually that I know more about the spiritual path than some people do. It's that every tiny scrap of information I have inside my head, I can put into words. So it's the quantity of words. It's not necessarily the quantity of understanding. Many people with far deeper understanding either don't have the same inclination toward words. They just don't have the same inclination towards words. Why bother? It was actually very interesting. When Swami wrote the oratorio, he commented that the inspiration he felt, because he wrote the oratorio, which is the life of Christ in music, he wrote it after a pilgrimage to Israel, where he went to all the places that a person goes, you know, when you're recreating in your own experience the life of Christ. He said the inspiration he felt inwardly was complete. It didn't require any kind of artistic expression in order to amplify it or clarify it. I mean, that's an important point, because for a lot of us, we might have a feeling about something, but we need to do something else with that feeling. Paint a painting, do a dance, write a piece of music, sing a song. In my case, bring whatever it is into clear focus verbally, either written or in words. And that I learn from doing that. I find out more. I find out more about my own experience by translating it into some creative medium. Swami made the comment that the experience was complete for him and that it wasn't amplified by creating the music. He created the music entirely so that others could also have an experience of a similar vibration to his own. But there was no compelling need in him. That's just interesting. A long time ago, when I was first learning about the caste system, Swami made the comment that most artistic expression is Vaishya. And Vaishya is the second caste. It's where we use our creativity for our own personal benefit. And creativity, the Vaishyas, the archetypal is the merchant, where the merchant is quite willing to give, but it's always a trade. The Kshatriya gives because it is the divine way to give, that unselfish generosity and the the archetype for that is the soldier or the king. People misunderstand the king. They think it's for self-aggrandizement, but the king is the servant of the people. But the soldier disciplines himself, even gives his whole life for the ideal, because the kshatriya lives by the ideals. It's not about what's in it for me. It's that my happiness comes when I conform to the ideal. The vaishya does it because there's something in it for him. And he's quite willing to give, but always if there's something in it for him. So I was quite upset when Swami said the most creative art is vaishya, because the artist does it because of the satisfaction it gives them. It's not, they don't do it necessarily, most artists don't do it just as an impersonal service. The artist does it because there's something in it for me. Now, that something in it for me may not be gross. It is merely because one gets something from it doesn't mean that it's gross. It can be a very high, refined level. But there's a necessity. There's a necessity to translate this experience into some form that I can see in order for it to instruct me and help me to understand my own feelings. Swami writes about this in Art is a Hidden Message, that the artist articulates in whatever form, doesn't have to be words to articulates, and then that clarifies the artist's own feelings, and then that's very helpful. Now, for Swamiji, he was making the distinction that there was nothing in it for him. It was a pure kshatriya act, actually even more a Brahmin act. It was done to please God, because he thought that the oratorio could awaken existing devotees of Jesus to a more inward understanding of that relationship, because that's the vibration of that music. So what I was starting with the words guide and bless, which again are just the words that I sometimes, you see, this is how you learn. I hear myself saying it. I think, that's interesting. Why do I always say that? Well, in the one of the later chapters of Swami's autobiography, The Path, when he's talking about spiritual family and the importance of spiritual family, it's passages I have often referred to. He talks about how, at a certain point in the soul's evolution, it gains the ability to attract and hold divine inspirations. And I've always realized, I've always been interested that there are two words. You have the good karma to attract it, but then you have to have enough good karma to be able to hold it. Because otherwise, it's an earlier stage where the opportunity will come to you, but it'll just slip through your fingers. And you won't really quite know what happened, and you won't know how to grasp it. But as we get more sincere and more refined and more in tune, we not only attract that blessing, but we have the capacity to hold it. It's interesting when I talk about my own life, sort of what I do and why I do it. I'm going on my fingers because sometimes I count it out like that. I met Swami Kriyananda at a very young age. I had the good karma to realize who he was to me, who he is, and who he is to me. I realized that. I had the opportunity to hear him share the teachings just beyond count. In private and public settings, I heard him share the teachings over and over. And I have a good memory for what he said. And so, they're all different things. I have a good memory for what he said. And then the last thing, I have a knack for knowing how it applies in the present instant, in the present inst, as they say, like now. And that's basically. But between attracting it and holding it, and that's where the words guide and bless come in. I was thinking, all of this is because I just thought of it. Just guide us, show us what's right, and then bless us with the ability to follow it. Because the guidance alone isn't always enough, because then all these different conflicting fears and preferences and anxieties and God knows, all of those things come sweltering in, swishing in, sweltering. Sweltering is not quite the right word. I have a picture of being in hell and sweltering in hell, but that's not what I mean. Just it comes streaming in. The guidance can come streaming in, but you have to, there's a grace of God in there, one, to be able to discern, as I was speaking yesterday. And then the other part of it is to have the capacity. And it's the grace of God, that's all there is. I have several things I want to talk about today. We were calling this humility, self-honesty. Yesterday I was talking about the likes and dislikes of the heart and how really subtle it is. Our preferences in these matters can become exceedingly subtle, especially if we're relatively refined. And so it's not as if we're choosing between, you know, going out and causing a lot of grief to a lot of people. We're often choosing among several different options, all of which are essentially positively inclined, but still it's not always easy to know among them which is the one that we really ought to follow. And I'm not sure I'll get to it today, but part of the problem is sometimes it really doesn't matter. It matters a great deal to us, but it matters much less to the divine which one we follow. We parse apart, you know, should I wear the pink dress? Should I wear the red dress? Should I wear the yellow dress? And we think that a great deal depends on which one of those colors we dress in. And all God wants us to do is just get dressed and go out and have our life. And sometimes we become too obsessed about the details. But I want to talk about that again in greater length and probably in a later day. So when I'm talking, as I was yesterday, about the likes and dislikes of the heart, we have to realize how very subtle that is. Swami Kriyananda, in his talking about this business of guidance, uses a classical example that Master used to help us understand how the different levels begin to trap and confuse us. And it's mon, buddhi, ahankara, and chitta. Now, those are Sanskrit words. And it means mind, in pure perception, intelligence, discrimination, and then feeling, which leads to likes and dislikes and attachment. And this was an image that Master used about how from pure perception, we gradually become biased in favor of the ego's preferences. So Master says just pure perception, pure consciousness, would see a vibrating form of light and would not like even know what it was. It's just a vibrating form of light. Everything in creation is the Om vibration and the light. It's just that we have it all divided up. When I look at this world, I see all these different pieces. This takes me back to when I was 10 and I stared out the window and I tried to get the illusion to dissolve into light. I mean, I didn't quite have it that clearly articulated in my 10-year-old mind, but in retrospect, that's exactly what I was doing. I knew the world was not really, the reality of the world I was looking at was different than what it seemed, and I just thought if I stared hard enough, the curtain would open. It didn't, but I remember trying very hard. So Master says, on the level of mon, it's just vibrating forms of light. Master himself said, if you could see yourselves as I see you, you would see that you are just beautiful colored light. Anandamoyi Ma, who was inclined to move in and out of ordinary awareness, I mean, her consciousness would soar into cosmic realms. Once Swami Kriyananda was there, and he was sitting right in front of her, and she asked, where is Kriyananda? Where is Kriyananda gone? And he was sitting literally right in front of her, but she couldn't discern who he was. And afterwards she sort of said, oh, don't take it personally, essentially. She said, sometimes I don't recognize people who've been with me for decades. It's just her mind would move out of the ability to the second level, which is mon buddhi, which is the intelligence, where it can take all these different forms of light and say, oh, you know, that one is a is a horse, that one is a person, that one is Kriyananda, this one is my mother, who it might be, that all the forms of light begin to take form, begin to take identity. So spirituality is not, as Sri Yukteswar said, is not dumbness. The intelligence is still there, and it can say, oh yeah, that form is a horse, I remember that one. That's what Master uses the horse as an example. Oh yeah, that's a horse. It's very impersonal because, in fact, it is a horse. The life trons, as the word Master used, it coalesces into a form that is recognizably a horse. And every time I come back to this spot, I'm going to see the horse. There's no ego involvement. There's no delusion involved. It just simply is what it is. Then comes the level where we discriminate. We don't merely identify, we begin to discriminate. And so you can begin to recognize that that particular horse is my horse, that there's lots of horses. There's a whole herd of horses, perhaps, that all the light forms have come together in all these different horses, and I see all these horses, I can identify everyone, but that one is mine. Now, on a certain level, you would think that that's the beginning of delusion, but if we incarnate in a physical body, it may actually be my horse. I may be responsible for it. I have to exercise it. I have to feed it. I have to take care of it. I have to watch out after its health. I have to take it to the veterinarian. If it needs help, I have to pay the vet bills. So I have to have some money so I can pay the vet bills, so I can take care of my horse. And certainly, this involves us in the material world. It goes a step further. It even commits us to the spiritual world. To the material world. Now, in other discussions that I've had, because I know it's a theme that I often talk about, I talk about the difference between being non-attached and being uncommitted. People get confused that they think that to be unattached, you can't commit yourself to taking care of my horse. You can't say, this is my horse, I have to take care of it. Watching Swami Kriyananda's life, he was intensely committed to the commission that Master had given him. And in my early years of Ananda, that was confusing to me. I thought that the way that I needed to hold myself aloof from the mission of Master, which included building Ananda and many other things that I've been part of, ever since. But I inwardly held myself aloof. Yes, I can see that this is a mission for Master, and I can see that a community is being built here, but I thought to be unattached was not to ever call that mission mine. And so I remained uncommitted in the name of being unattached. And I remember, as I've shared with many of you, just one particular day riding in the car with Swami, driving through the community. And it crossed my mind that Swami was pouring out his life's blood to make this community work. And if that's how he was responding to it, and I thought I was being spiritual by remaining aloof, there was some disconnect there that didn't actually seem, it seemed likely that I was misunderstanding something. And actually, the way I got into eventually real commitment to Master's mission was that it was my friendship with Swamiji. He was my friend. He was giving everything he had to make this project work. If I was going to be his friend, I needed to support him in what was important to him. And it was just simple gratitude, if nothing else, because I was certainly willing to take from Swamiji. So it crossed my mind that maybe friendship demanded that I also give. So my first sort of stepping into commitment was through my commitment to being his friend. And then over time, I began to understand that Master's mission is my mission. I can call it my mission. Now, what Swami points out is we're not actually bound merely by taking responsibility. And in fact, we grow spiritually when we take responsibility, because when we take responsibility, it compels us to wrestle with the three gunas. And it's the three gunas that bind us, the gunas, tamasic energy, downward pulling, contractive darkening energy, rajasic energy. Lots and lots happening, but not necessarily with any direction. It can be rajasic toward darkening. We can be avidly pursuing darkening experiences. And sattvic is calm, peaceful, divinely attuned. So we can use our rajasic energy to create sattvic energy, or we can use our rajasic energy to create tamasic energy. And when we begin to take responsibility for something, we are compelled to wrestle with the three gunas. Because once we're responsible, then we have to fight against pure rajas, which just wants to go in circles and accomplish nothing, or rajas, which wants to go down into tamasic energy. I'll deal with it tomorrow. As writers, not all writers, but many writers, can be notorious procrastinators. And one woman writer, who's after my own heart, said, "Thank God for my writing deadlines, otherwise I'd never get any of my housework done." And what she means by that, of course, is as soon as the next thing on the schedule is to finish the article that she promised to the magazine, she'll just use her rajasic energy to do anything else. So she does all her housework first before she does it. And I mean, I've watched myself do exactly the same thing. The pressure of that deadline causes all these other postponed projects to suddenly move to the top of the list. But if we've taken responsibility, you've taken responsibility for a family, you have to support that family. You have to write that article because that's how you're going to support the family. It forces you to wrestle with the gunas. And Triguna Rahitam is a definition of the guru, which means he has transcended the influence of all three of the gunas. And how do we transcend it? We transcend it when we're compelled to. We're compelled to because we've become committed to some objective that we're responsible for. And then we begin to progress in that way. Swami Kriyananda himself said, "I never define myself as Swami Kriyananda. I don't identify with Swami Kriyananda," he said. He's speaking of himself. Swami Kriyananda is who he appears to be. He said, "I never identify or define myself as Swami Kriyananda, but Swami Kriyananda is an event for which I am responsible." Because his consciousness perceives that the material, the lightrons, the lifetrons, and the lightrons have all coalesced into the form of Kriyananda, and Kriyananda has certain responsibilities he has to carry out in the world, so he carries them out. So there's mon, there's just a perception of lifetrons, there's buddhi, which says, "Oh, these lifetrons form me," and you know, or form Swami Kriyananda, and then the third ahankara says, "Oh, this is me. I am responsible for Swami Kriyananda and all the things, the mission that Master has given me," and all on like that. But we're still not bound. Where we become bound is at the level of citta. Citta is feeling. In its pure form, citta is calm, devotional, uplifted joy feeling. It's the experience, sat chid ananda, which is ever existing, ever conscious, ever new joy. That's what it is. It's right there. But in the terms of Maya and delusion, what happens is, oh, there's the life, there's the light. It's formed itself into a horse. I recognize that as my horse, and then we say, "Oh, I'm so happy when I see my horse. It makes me so happy that that's my horse." And as soon as we've done that, you see, we've set up the opposite. As soon as our happiness is conditioned by some reality, then immediately, if that condition changes, our happiness leaves us. So we've now bound ourselves to making the world a certain way because my happiness depends on it. It's not the same as saying I'm responsible and I'll carry it out because it's my duty to do so. And of course, we can be very joyous carrying out our duty, but our happiness is because we're doing what the divine wants of us. This is Mother Teresa of Calcutta, her brilliant line, when she was quizzed about how much, you know, the statistical proof of the benefit of the work she was doing to uplift the poor. And like, you know, can certain NGOs, non-governmental organizations, NGOs, a word they use in India a lot, maybe NGOs could be more efficient than you and your nuns at helping the poor. Statistically, you could help more people. And Mother Teresa, in her very blunt way, just looked at the journal, said, "I'm not helping the poor." And the journalist just looked so bewildered because, you know, what else was she doing? "I'm doing what Jesus asked me to do." Because, you see, that's an energy and a consciousness, what Jesus asked me to do. And Jesus put it in the form of helping the poor, but I'm not helping the poor because the poor need my help. I'm helping the poor because Jesus asked me to. And so it's a responsibility I have. But the responsibility is not to help the poor. The responsibility is to do what Jesus asked me to do. And as long as he wants me to do this, this is what I'll do. But my happiness is not conditioned by any form in this world. My happiness is that I listen, I am guided and blessed by Jesus. And that's pure consciousness. And there's no bondage, you see, in pure consciousness. The bondage is when we extend our definition of happiness into the material world. And of course, this is why the likes and dislikes are so difficult. Because we start out in any number of places, and it's very easy to say these words. It's exceedingly difficult to live by them. And this is where self-honesty and humility, I haven't gone into it as much as I will. I think I'll talk more about it tomorrow, probably. But this is where we have to become exceedingly honest. And that honesty, it comes from so many levels. It comes from recognizing that God's love for us is unconditional. You know, we're so nervous about not being good enough. It just follows us like a stinky cloud all over the place. And we're so conditional in the way that we relate to the world that we find it difficult even to imagine what the consciousness of Divine Mother is toward us. You know, to be totally loved no matter who we are. And we have to realize that we're not her favorites. That she's a mother who has absolutely no favorites. And every sentient being is equally the child of Divine Mother and equally loved. The mother cheers the monkey for becoming a slightly better monkey and moving on toward what it's going to become. The mother cheers the most villainous human for becoming slightly less villainous because she's unconditional in her love, and she's going to take every one of her children through every stage that child needs to go through, and she's going to do it with the same limitless patience and limitless happiness and limitless love. And so self-honesty begins with the realization that I'm safe. I don't have to prove myself. I may want to wrestle with the gunas and become a better person. That's a good idea, because then my own experience of happiness will be more consistent and my experience of suffering will diminish and eventually disappear. But it's not to earn Mother's love, because that's the given. I mean, it's a profound and vitally important meditation, not merely to offer our love to God, but to remove all the self-concerns that keep us from believing in her love. And once we have that, then we can just be who we are. And when we become unafraid to be who we are, then we can begin to work more effectively and realistically with what we're supposed to do. In other words, with our intuition and our guidance, because our intuition is free now. It doesn't have to protect and support some fragile need to establish our self-worth in a certain way. Now, I think there's more that could be said about it, but I think that's all we'll say for this morning, and we'll continue with this tomorrow. Bless you.